Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
At the summit for Valbara, the Asteri give their blessing, and all the Crescent City players show up to discuss the future of their territory. Hunt stands by as one of Sandriel's minions, while in the city, Bryce continues to look for a way to free Hunt despite their differences. Though Micah should be at the summit as well, he makes excuses to leave partway through, only to arrive at Griffin Antiquities. He reveals the location of Luna's Horn, as well as his involvement in the death of Danica and the Pack of Devils. Bryce manages to get out a message for help that makes all of Crescent City's leaders aware of Micah's treachery, and the leaders of the summit watch on in horror as Bryce and her friends fight for their lives.
The views expressed by the hosts are entirely their own and in no way represent the thoughts or intentions of the original author.
This podcast is a discussion, shared to spark thought and conversation on the characters and themes of this novel.
The interpretations presented in this podcast are just a few of the many possibilities. Listeners are encouraged to read along and share their own analysis of the text.
Though the hosts speak mostly within the constraints of this book, series and extended universe spoilers may be discussed with or without warning.
Explicit language, as well as themes of sex, violence, abuse, depression, self-harm, and death will recur throughout this podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
This is part one of this week's episode. Stick around for part two, which releases on Thursday.
Welcome to Book Talk for Book Talk, a podcast where we deep dive into the writing of your favorite novels.
This season, we are exploring Sarah J. Maas's first installment in the Crescent City series.
This is Jack.
And I'm Amy.
This week, we're discussing chapters 73 through 79 in A House of Earth and Blood.
This week, we ask ourselves, why is this section still the most impactful section in all of the Crescent City series?
The theme we'll see this week is hopelessness.
As well as maybe friendship. I didn't add that.
Well, I think that's involved with hopelessness.
Oh, okay. I think we should also add to the disclaimer, there may be tears.
Yeah, I was about to say I don't want to talk about it, but that's literally what we have to do is talk about it.
That's our job.
Okay, let's get, it's not until chapter 79. It's fine. I'll be great.
We'll be fine. Chapter 73 begins with the summit for the southeast region of Valbara, and our expectations for this summit are subverted immediately, just like our previous expectations for the holding cells at the Comitium might have been last week. Now, this book is a romantasy, in case you've forgotten, and if you think about all of SJM's past work, I think we're naturally, as readers, going to think of castles and stone dungeons because that's what we've seen in Throne of Glass and A Court of Thorns and Roses. Instead, we're in a conference room.
Yeah.
Like us, Hunt's expectations are subverted as well. Quote, the last summit Hunt had attended had been in an ancient sprawling palace in Pangaea, bedecked in the riches of the empire. Silk tapestries in sconces of pure gold, goblets twinkling with precious stones. This one was held in a conference center. The glass and metal space was sprawling. I think the subversion shows how off-kilter Hunt is mentally, and we are probably too, given all that's happened leading up to this moment. I also want to point out that the glass and metal structure feels very impersonal. There's nothing homey about a conference center, and it creates distance between who Hunt is in this space. He doesn't belong, just like pretty much nobody belongs.
Yeah, I mean, reading the whole thing of, like, describing the conference center, people being in business casual and, like, being bored. It was very triggering.
It was.
I was there. I felt it.
Yep.
I also wanted to look at this description, and it's part of what you read, where everything before was pure gold, goblets twinkling with precious stones. Everything was you know, kind of really over the top. And I think it's meant to showcase how far they, the veneer, have come, because it's almost like they viewed that previous stone and riches as backwards. Mm-hmm. And now they're sophisticated. Mm. Now they're a republic. Now they have technology. They are above such things. The humans now are the ones who live in the poor areas, who don't have technology mm-hmm. like the veneer do. And so I think it's meant to be almost like an overcompensation of like, we're so civil. This whole sham of everything, it's because we're so civil. We're nothing like those humans. And, you know, it's just like, showy is bad, composed is good. And this whole entire thing is like also leading up the way of how they're faking civility, just like they're faking the Republic.
Yeah.
Everyone knows they're going to be told what to do at the end of the day.
Right, right. We're going to talk about that too this episode. We learn at this point that Hunt has been locked up for the past 5 days, during which he has been fed 3 proper meals each day. While food is normally seen as power, in this case, it's not Hunt that is powerful. The food is established as Sandriel's power over Hunt. And we see that in Hunt's gear and what he's wearing right now during the summit. He has no weapons when he's let out of the holding cell, and he is chained in Gorsian manacles, which limit his power. Quote, "No weapons, but the black uniform was clear enough. So was the message. He was about to be displayed, a mockery of an imperial triumphus parade, for Sandriel to gloat about regaining ownership of him." It's also a mockery, in my mind, of who Hunt used to be. What we're seeing right now is the Umbra Mortis with his clipped wings. Like, he is a caged bird. By the end of the summit, we're going to see changes that allow Hunt to say goodbye of that, or goodbye to that version of himself, and move toward the future.
Yeah, I'm going to yes and. So yes to everything, and I think it's both degrading and degrading in this other different way. So it's kind of a combination of a 1-2 punch, the fact that they're delivering him clothes and food all at the same time. So the quote, "set of black clothes" had arrived with his breakfast tray. It's really showing that they aren't starving him. He's wearing black clothes. There's nothing really shameful about it.
Yeah.
Like, they're not parading him in "I'm a loser" shirt, you know, or naked. And a lot of times when we read fantasy, or not just like read or TV shows, like, you'll see people when they're being shamed, they're naked, or they're meant to wear something really degrading. And yes, it is a mockery of his Umbra Mortis status, but it's also not that bad.
Yeah.
And I think it's meant to almost show off how little they fear him. We don't need to starve you.
Yeah.
We don't need to humiliate you. We own you.
Yeah.
He's not without anything, and yet he's still captive. He's not even being tortured. He is just a captive.
Yeah. I think that's a great point. I think it's also important to note that he's probably the most underdressed right now.
Yeah. Probably really comfortable.
Probably really comfortable. Good for Hunt. But I think, to your point, you know, he isn't without, but somehow he's being made to feel without, even though he doesn't want what everybody else has.
Yeah, his emotions are a little all over the place.
They are.
Because it's like, I'm here to be mocked and paraded, but like, thank God I'm not him. We'll get into that.
That's right. So the summit opening is a total dog and pony show. And if we step away from Hunt and look at Isaiah and the Legion and anyone else, they are dressed to the nines. If we remember from earlier in the novel, Hunt had bemoaned having to get his golden breastplate cleaned. And that's exactly what Isaiah is wearing right now. Quote, "The bronze breastplate, the epaulets, the greaves and vambraces, Hunt still remembered how heavy it was, how stupid he'd always felt decked out in the full regalia of the Imperial Army, like some prize war horse." So what we're seeing right now is the celebratory armor that Isaiah is wearing that Hunt was supposed to wear had he still been with the Legion. Many different people are wearing different types of celebratory robes, but I want to point out specifically the idea that Hunt remembers how heavy the armor was. that armor, in my mind, has become a sign of Micah's ownership. Micah's ownership, the Republic's ownership, Asteri's ownership. But in this moment, Hunt is free of that burden. He doesn't have to wear that armor. He's just wearing some simple black clothes. Because even though he's now owned by Sandriel, he's free of the burden of Micah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not necessarily better.
Yeah.
But I think the symbolism is important to see here.
Yeah. Well, it's almost like there's more of a dog and pony show with Micah.
Yeah.
Versus
Sandriel.
Sandriel is like stripped down. You're just a flat out prisoner.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Whereas Micah would like, likes to fool people into thinking that they've got some sort of agency.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's also symbolic that Hunt is here right now because he's literally lost everything. He's lost his friends. He's lost his position. He's lost his deal with Micah. And that's that armor that's been removed that used to feel heavy. And I think that had to happen for Hunt to be able to move forward.
Yeah.
I don't think he was ever fully going to be able to move forward until he had hit rock bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And we can talk about that more later.
Yeah, but I mean, to your point, the fact that he has hit rock bottom kind of adds a certain level of clarity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and his emotions are definitely swinging all over the place. I don't even mention it in my notes, but I'm going to now, where he's just like, Bryce lied to me plenty. And I was like, shut up. You know, it's like Therian brought Bryce to the docks. Shut up. Like, but his emotions are all over.
Yeah.
And even when it comes to how Isaiah is there and how he's dressed. And if we remember the last time Hunt saw Isaiah, Hunt was the one who was pitied.
Mm-hmm.
And now this time he's pitying Isaiah. He's looking at him saying, you're the one who's actually captured.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's a certain freedom of like everyone in the room knows that he's a prisoner.
Right.
He's a slave and prisoner.
Right.
Over there, it's a mockery.
Right.
Where Isaiah is still a slave, but pretending to be some kind of free slave. It, you know, there's freedom in the truth there. And clothes really represent a lot more in this section, more than it has in any other time of this book, really. Mm-hmm. I feel like SJM's like really tapping into some of her older stuff. Like the fact that he compared Isaiah to a war horse. When, you know, go back and listen to our ACOTAR season. We talked a lot about comparing people to animals.
Yeah.
And maybe because in this world, everyone's a shifter of some kind.
Yeah.
You don't get that a lot.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're kind of coming back into this idea of symbolism.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to get into that of symbolism. And I kind of attached my notes with your notes. So we're going to ping pong a little.
Okay. I'm going to talk about the use of color in the setting as well as clothing.
And then I'm going to jump into some of the other symbolism that we might see in the fashion choices.
For the next three-ish people, I'm going to talk about the use of night to describe some of the leaders who are representing their units. So let's start with Jessica. She wears a black dress and a, quote, midnight cape.
The drama of a midnight
cape. So drama.
I know. And then she's even described as wearing ancient gold, which is not just a breadcrumb to who she is.
Such a breadcrumb.
But is also like, how are we supposed to know it's ancient?
How does Hunt know anything about the gold?
Right? I can't look at gold and be like, that's ancient.
Yeah.
No, it's just, it's a big old spit in our face breadcrumb.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And we don't think about it.
God, no, we don't.
Then there's Hypaxia, whose hair, quote, gleams like spun night.
And in that hair is a crown of gold and red cloudberries. And I was like, the hell are cloudberries? Never heard of them. And it turns out cloudberries are native to really cold climates and are hard to grow and harvest. Very similar to Hypaxia, who was, you know, raised very remote, very away.
Mm-hmm. Good point. The third person I want to think about is the Autumn King, who wears an onyx crown, quote, the ancient stone like a piece of night.
And onyx is such a choice to have for the Autumn King.
Mm-hmm.
Why not
gold?
Gold. Why not rubies? Why not like anything else? Like Onyx, I never thought in a million years, even when I reread it, I was like, well, Onyx? Why? And I looked more into the meaning of Onyx, and Onyx is very much meant to represent strength and purification and protection. Even Cleopatra was said to have worn black onyx for protection. And then when you look into the history of onyx, onyx itself means fingernail or claw, because Cupid cut Venus's fingernail while she was sleeping and it fell to earth and became onyx.
Wow.
Right? And then I like...
So it's dead fingernails.
Dead finger, which I... God, that really creeped me out. But you have this idea of like protection and claws for that to be on the crown. And you have to remember that the crown is meant to go to Rune also, so it's not meant to just represent the Autumn King. So you might look at this and say this is the whole line, but I just thought it was very poignant that it was Onyx. And I'm going to take a quick pause before Amy continues with the descriptions of everyone, because I couldn't find another place to put this. But Hunt looks at the Autumn King at one point and thinks, quote, Bryce looked more like her father than Rune did. Granted, plenty of Fae had that coloring, but the coldness of the Autumn King's face. He just called Bryce cold.
And it's kind of one, I feel like it's kind of one of the first times, maybe the second time that we've seen that description, but it's but it will become more frequent in the future books.
We've seen it a couple times in this book. We'll see it way more next book. And yeah. I was like, damn. Cold. But back to the descriptions.
So who do we normally associate with Night? I would not say it's Jessiba, Hypaxia, or the Autumn King. Normally, I would say it's Rune. However, in this moment, Rune doesn't have Night descriptions associated with him. He brings the Star Sword, and Hunt describes him as looking or having the same coloring as the Starborn of old.
And how are we supposed to know what the Starborn of old's coloring was?
Yeah, don't know.
I like, what is that? But allowed. Rune is also wearing gilded birch leaves, which makes sense to me because he's a prince.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
And because birch leaves represent spring and the mark of a new beginning. So, of course, the prince would have the symbol of new beginning because he'll be next in line.
Yeah.
In theory.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
So why the use of Night associated with these three individuals, if not Rune? Because we know Rune is good. He is a good male. We don't really know a lot about Jessiba, Hypaxia, and the Autumn King. Hypaxia, we kind of have a better sense of. But I wonder if in this moment, SJM was trying to code these three as mysterious and swaying to the side of good. Because if you look at Sabine, Sabine's just in a dove gray suit. She is full on morally gray character.
Yeah. Yeah. And not just like Sabine, but later on, we're going to get Jessiba in a gray suit, which is, she's also supposed to be morally gray. But then it's like, how are we supposed to know if some people turn out to be good or evil? I just feel like we've been set up.
Yeah, I feel like SJM made some deliberate choices here that I don't understand. At least in terms of the use of, like, Night.
Yes.
That was so specific, and I don't feel like it played out.
Agreed.
A different color stood out to me at the start of the chapter, and that is the color of white. There is a white carpet that is kind of like the pathway. They rolled out the white carpet, not the red carpet, for this summit. And when you look around at all the other people present for the summit, it really reflects the stark whiteness of the angel's wings in the Asterion Guard. Hunt thinks at some point, quote, only the whitest, purest wings would do, not one speck of color on them. It's like their goodness, quote unquote, is being overstated, that those who ally with the Asteri are good and therefore white. And it's just ironic.
It's just, you know, like not so subtle examples of racism.
Yeah.
You know,
totally.
Of just being like white wings, blonde hair.
Good.
It's giving Aryan youth. Mm-hmm. It's giving not great.
Not good things.
No.
I also wanted to point out that the Asterion Guard are 49 angels, aka 7 times 7.
That was smart. I didn't realize that until I saw your notes, and I was like, that's some Taylor Swift shit.
That is some Taylor Swift shit. The other color that really stands out to me throughout these sections is gold. And I feel like gold is also used to highlight the Asteres and the Republic's goodness. We see gold in the Legion's armor, in the Asterian Guard's armor, and even Pollux is wearing gold.
Yeah.
The dais that the Asteres thrones are on when they come on the screen is also gold.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that symbolize? Quote, "There was only the Vanir side, the good side, and no other."
It's just like, I like gold. So that felt like an attack. I ask you this again, Amy. You'll not have an answer.
Mm.
Nor will SJM.
Mm-hmm.
Why is Fury there? She's not even with a house. She's just there houseless.
Yeah.
And they're letting her be.
Yeah. I'm going to guess she's being paid to protect someone or keep someone in line. I don't know.
You're being generous.
Yeah. She's there so that she has a helicopter.
Yeah, that's fair.
To get Hunt where he needs to go. She is a plot device.
You know, she really does come through with that helicopter a couple times.
She does. But at the... Yeah, I... It hurts that she is a plot device.
Absolutely.
I feel like she could be so much more.
Like, one of... Like, a character who could be one of SJM's great queer characters.
Yeah.
Is a total plot device.
Yep.
For now. Who knows?
Maybe there's a future where she's not. At this moment, she is.
Yep.
I also want to point out this one small breadcrumb before we move into the next chapter. Hunt, while watching the Asteri address the summit, thinks, quote, "This empire had been built to last for eternity. In more than 15,000 years, it had not broken. This war would not be the thing that ended it." So it's a breadcrumb because it's ironic. Because eventually things will change. This war will be what ends the Asteri.
Yeah, like the war starts here.
Right, exactly. However, what's really important to me about this quote is that it shows how hopeless Hunt is. And that resonates throughout this set of chapters, not just from Hunt's perspective, but Rune's perspective and other perspectives as well. And he thinks it again later on. Quote, "The room echoed the words, albeit half-heartedly, as if everyone remembered that even in this land across the sea from Pangaea, even here, there was no escaping."
Hunt really swings back and forth from defiant to hopeless. You know, like he goes from like, "There, like, we will never get out of this," to that almost like hint of rebel in him.
Mm-hmm.
The one who did rebel with Shahar. Their names are so similar. Mm-hmm. The one who did rebel with Shahar. Like, there is that defiantness in there. Mm-hmm. But then he goes back to that hopelessness. And I like that we get to see Defiant Hunt in this book because I don't think we see him again.
Yeah.
Dare I say, spoiler for book three, ever.
It's not that big of a spoiler.
But it's still like, you know, yeah, you never know what people don't want spoiled. But I really wish that SJM reflected on this section in book three, because
mm-hmm.
I think, or maybe I missed it. Maybe there, like, he does, and because I haven't done the reread, maybe he does reflect on this. But I feel like this little seed of rebelliousness,
mm-hmm.
I don't see this from him again.
Yeah, I don't either.
Yeah.
From what I recall.
And this would have been, yeah. And this would have been a good moment to think back to, you know, like, wow, that moment when I was in the conference room.
Well, I mean, I think that just speaks to who Hunt is.
Yeah.
And he has been dealt enough trauma related to the people that he loves
mm-hmm.
that rebellion means nothing in the face of their potential harm.
Yeah. Yeah. We go into chapter 74, and Bryce is dealing with her identity issues and what it means to have her identity out and about now. Quote, "As if being a bastard princess meant anything, as if it said anything about her as a person." It's painful to think about all the times that she called Rune Prince.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it really is a big fat karma moment where and I love Bryce, you know, and you can argue Rune deserved it all those times, but all the times that you directed it at him, now you're feeling it where it's like, yeah, you know what? being something, being having a title is you're more than that.
Yeah. Yep.
And it's a theme that she's going to struggle with well into book two.
Oh, yeah. If not beyond that, too, in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
In this scene with Bryce in Griffin Antiquities, we see glimpses where SJM is trying to remind us that Bryce and Hunt are the same. And ultimately, I think that's why Bryce beyond him being her friend, continues to search for ways to free him. Despite him lying to her, they are at their core very, very similar.
Mm-hmm.
And their capacity for empathy for one another is so large.
Yeah.
How can Bryce not try to fight for him?
Yep.
Quote, she didn't believe Hunt's bullshit last words for her. She would have said the same thing had she been in his place. Would have been as nasty as she could if it would have gotten him to safety. Like, they just understand each other so well.
I just love that I don't have to deal with pages of, and I don't think he wants me anymore.
Right.
I couldn't deal with that.
Yeah.
It's like, he did a go home lassie.
Yeah. Yeah. And she saw it for what it was.
Yep.
Regardless of that, though, Bryce is not in a good mindset. Quote, maybe being attacked by that Crystallos was payment for her fuck-ups. So she's not here, woe is me, Hunt doesn't love me, but I'm still willing to fight for him even though he lied to me. She's more of just like, well, karma's coming back to bite me in the ass.
Yeah. Karma is not her boyfriend.
Or her cat sitting in her lap because it loves her.
Nope.
Unlike Hunt, Bryce is offered a glimmer of hope. An envelope from Isaiah comes to the shop, and it contains the white opal that Hunt had gifted Bryce that Bryce threw at Hunt in last week's episode. However, Bryce doesn't hold on to it. She puts it away in a desk drawer. And I wonder if it's because the opal does not represent actual hope, but a fallacy of their life before, of their relationship before.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, it's just too much of a reminder of Hunt lying to her. I don't know.
It's the opal and her putting it away. I feel like she has enough things clinging onto him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's every single book that's surrounding her trying to find his freedom.
Right.
And it's almost like this version of her that received the opal was ignorant.
Yeah.
She didn't get shit done.
Yeah.
But this version of Bryce needs to get shit done.
Yeah.
I'll be sentimental later.
Yeah.
Like, it just felt a little bit more efficient. And the only reason why I felt that way is because this reading here in this section, Bryce seems to have forgiven Hunt. And I know we did get that last episode where she's trying to buy back his freedom.
Right.
But because we never get the moment where she's like, I officially pardon thee. Yeah. Like, you may go forth. But we get the vibe there. We get it for sure here.
Yeah.
We see that where the fact that she keeps the opal, the fact that she sleeps in his bed. And it's, you know, I do appreciate that there's like a level-headedness about her.
Yeah.
You know, now because like her trying to buy back his freedom was not level-headed. Her doing research, trying to find the loophole is level-headed.
Right. And I think also to some extent, she's like, I can hold on to this when we get to be in the same room together again. Like when we get to renew our friendship.
Yeah.
Right now is not time for me to think about our friendship.
Yep.
In that way.
Yep. And because SJM is pure evil, she has Lahaba tell Bryce. I hate it.
Quote, I'm just shaking my head.
Quote. You, me, and Siri, together, we'll get through this.
You crying?
No, not yet. You'll know.
You'll know. We then move into chapter 75, and we're back at the summit, and this time in Rune's point of view. Like Hunt, Rune has expectations of the summit that are thwarted. Quote, Rune had anticipated that the summit would be intense, vicious, flat-out dangerous, each moment spent wondering whether someone's throat would be ripped out, just as it was at every one he'd attended. This time, his only enemy seemed to be boredom. Don't worry, Rune. There will be plenty of excitement soon. And I do wonder if SJM is playing on these expectations because we also expect something to happen at the summit, when in fact all the action's going to be
away from the summit.
Away from the summit.
Yep.
And so what we're seeing is SJM play out for her characters what's going to happen to us, which I think is just really clever writing. Oh,
so well done.
Also, like Hunt and Bryce, I felt like I was sensing this theme of all these three characters doubting themselves. And we see that in Rune here as well. Especially after he finds out who Hypaxia really is, he finally knows, oh, this meta witch that I kind of have a crush on who's been helping me, oh, is supposed to be my betrothed? What?
Mm-hmm.
Quote, with her healing gifts, could she sense whatever was wrong inside him that would mean he was the last of his bloodline? I don't know why I wrote this note, really, but it was interesting to see how all over the place, how each of these characters, Hunt, Bryce, Rune, their emotions are constantly in flux.
Mm-hmm.
Their thoughts are constantly in flux, and no one's in a good place right now.
Yeah, I will say, I feel like Rune's self-esteem has always been pretty gone and low and non-existent.
Yeah. True.
You don't realize how much he hates himself until, I don't know, even analyzing this, like in the beginning of the book, it was like, Rune Danon, Crown Prince of the Valbaran Fae. And now it's like, he literally says, maybe her power saw something that's wrong with me in the inside.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So sad.
That's some sad boy.
Yeah.
Sad boy.
That's the reason why he looks emo. He is emo.
Because he is. At one point, Rune tries to confront Hypaxia about her identity and asks why she didn't say anything. Quote, Hypaxia held her lunch tray with a grace better suited to hold a scepter. You didn't ask? First off, like, that's just dumb. Like, how is he supposed to ask that? Like, when he meets her, do you happen to be the new queen of the witches and my potential betrothed?
In her defense, he never, ever asks her name. He has interacted with her multiple times.
In his defense, she walks away before asking the first time, and then he has no excuse the other time.
Who doesn't tell someone, oh, by the way, my name is Amy? You make sure people know you're Jack.
Oh, I do.
Like Frost or Daniels.
That is exactly what I tell people. Because when I say, hi, what's your name? Jack. They look at me confused and I'll say, like Frost. Yeah. Like Frost or Daniel. Like Daniels or, Frost or Daniels.
I think you say Daniels or Frost.
Like Daniels or Frost. Yeah. And then you see the logic. But yeah, no, it's a silly question. But what I really wanted to get into is the fact that she's holding her own food tray. And that means a couple things to me. One, it's really funny that you have this image of a queen holding her own food tray.
I couldn't handle it. I couldn't even write about it, apparently.
Yeah, like there's just something about like that she's choosing people not to hold it for her. Mm-hmm. And then if you want to get a little bit more spoilerish for book three, it's also giving her community and the witches that should be supporting her not respecting her.
Yeah.
And these are early signs of that.
Yeah. I mean, we sense that in book two as well.
Yes. But another part, if you also want to look into the symbolism, is the fact that we've talked about before that food is power. And the way that she is holding the tray, it should be beneath her. But Rune sees the power for what it is and the fact that she should be holding a scepter.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So in this moment, food, there's something about food on a tray that's immediately like diminishes the concept of food as power.
Yeah.
Because it's like serving food.
It's a cafeteria.
Yeah, it's a cafeteria.
It's plebeian.
I would thrive. I love bad food. But he sees past that and sees the power within her food.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically, the tray does nothing to disguise her power from him.
Yeah. But did disguise her name.
Oh, yeah. Whatever.
Rune boy.
I do want to say it's very, very clever for Sandriel to say, quote, Mike has been called away and will be joining us later. And then Hunt thinks, oh, yeah, there it could only be the Asteri who call Mike away.
Mm-hmm.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yep.
It's not the case. And no one dwells on it for very long. No one questions it.
Well, why would anyone?
Right.
It's like the boss went and needed to take a phone call.
Right. But it's brilliant. That aside, like Hunt was a couple chapters ago, Rune is equally hopeless. He sees the pattern that the Republic and the Asteri have built. Quote, "None of it, the negotiating, would matter in the end. Sandriel and Micah would get what they wanted, and everything would remain the same." And it's ironic because they don't.
Yeah.
They die.
Yeah.
But the sentiment is real, and that sentiment continues for a long time mm-hmm. into the next two books.
Yeah. The last little section of this chapter is in Hunt's point of view, and it's just like a few paragraphs of more hopelessness.
Yeah.
And it's funny because in the reread and the analysis, you're like, I'm like, damn, Sarah, you are going heavy-handed of like, everything sucks.
Yeah.
It's all miserable. We're never going to win.
Yeah.
And it's not, but it doesn't feel, it's heavy-handed in the right way.
In the right way, because we all agree.
Yeah.
Bryce didn't free Hunt. They're all in this shitty situation. It's hopeless. We're meant to feel this way. We don't know how the fuck they're going to come back from this.
Yeah.
So,
but yeah. It's done so well. It's written so well because it doesn't feel like I'm being told. I'm being shown.
Yeah, I agree. And what we're not being told we're meant to feel this way. We empathize with the characters who are feeling this way.
Yeah.
That hopelessness continues in chapter 76 for Bryce in the form of food. Her fridge at home is empty. Mm-hmm. She's not feeding herself properly. She's got a bunch of, I'm going to assume, empty takeout containers scattered all over the gallery because she's practically living there. But you know what? She's got a mini fridge full of cheese. And that's just really not the best gut situation on the planet.
Oh, I'm on board. Bryce and I are soul sisters. And God, I want a fridge full of cheese.
Yeah, but I bet she's backed up.
There are pills for that. That's fine.
She's not taking care of her body in terms of food. She's not in a prime condition for what's about to go down. And it's interesting because it's the exact opposite of Hunt, who's the captive, mm-hmm. who's been getting 3 square meals a day. They're probably relatively healthy because, like you said, Jack, he needs to stay strong. I don't know if Bryce is taking care of her body right now.
So,
but at least she's wearing athleisure wear.
Yeah, real convenient coming up
real
for that one.
Real convenient.
I'm going to yes and. So I'm going to look at it as a slightly different way in the sense that she's being a parallel for Hunt, where at first we're introduced to Hunt and he's a prisoner, mm-hmm. but he's being fed. Same way. At first we're being introduced with Bryce here and she has no food in her fridge, except we're realizing that there's cartons of takeaway food. Is it the healthiest food? No, but she's eating. And we've seen her go through bouts of not eating.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
Is it the healthiest? No, but she's been more unhealthy.
Yeah, no, that's a great point.
And it's enough to keep going. And it's the same thing where it's like, Hunt's clothing has shifted, mm-hmm. and so has hers.
Yeah.
And neither of them, like, Hunt is supposed to represent a mockery, but it actually is freedom, like, freeing. Mm-hmm. And hers is supposed to represent giving up, but it's actually what will save her.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point. Bryce makes a comment mentally at one point that, like, oh, it's a good thing Jessica's not paying attention because she'd be really pissed off with all the mess that I've created with all my empty food cartons. And I have to ask, does Jessica really not know, or does she just not care?
I think she's giving Bryce grace. Like, she's always done a little bit of that. Mm-hmm. Bryce has already said it's a slow week in Lunathian. Nothing's really happening. So, in my mind, Jessica's like, you're lucky I'm away.
Yeah, yeah. Fair. We get a kind of sense from this scene when Bryce mentions that she's got some job interviews that maybe she's finally ready to move on. And what is she moving on from? I think that Hunt's capture has really put a lot of things into perspective for Bryce, mm-hmm. as we're going to see as this episode plays out, right? We're going to see that she bought Lahaba's freedom. She's finally applied for those jobs that she's wanted to apply for, and she's doing the thing she should never have waited on.
Yeah.
But she chose to wait on until all this shit went down with Hunt. And I think it primes her for embracing the future. Mm-hmm. That she needed to go through this low period to be able to take the next step in her life.
Mm-hmm.
Bryce is in the gallery library, just as she's been every time we've seen her since the summit began, doing research on Hunt. And it's here that Micah corners her. But before he shows up, the knock starts acting like a creep, like scratching at the glass, smiling at Bryce.
So gross.
So gross. Like a creepy, creepy peeping Tom. And then when Micah is there, the knock kept smiling. Now, I want to suggest that the knock is symbolic of Micah.
Mm-hmm.
And as we see everything play out in the library, if we remember, Syrinx has been metaphorical for Hunt.
Yep.
And if we think of Nock as being a metaphor for Micah, we're going to see the Nock attack Syrinx, much like Micah was using and disposed of Hunt.
I love it. I love it. I think you are spot on. I don't understand why these powerful characters are just so casual. And I'm referencing the Autumn King here. Mm-hmm. Like, when Micah shows up, he's in a pair of dark jeans and Nikes. I'm already quoting. He's a pair of boots and dark jeans, but all I can think of is dark jeans and your Nikes. Look at you.
Yeah.
Oh, damn. Never seen that color blue. Like, what? He had to change to get into, like, for this. Like, he had to go put on his murder clothes.
Yeah.
And he chose jeans.
Yeah.
Dark jeans for this. Like, if you're going to be a villain, that's how you go.
Right.
You know, that's all. It just, and again, but it comes back to the fact that, like, casualness is fake, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's the same way that it's business professional mm-hmm. in the summit. It's all fake.
Yeah.
His casualty is all fake.
His casualness?
His casualness is all fake. And his casualties. Now I'm going to stick to it. I'm going to double down. I heard it and I was like, damn it. Jessica is, like, putting the interaction on the screen. I always kind of wonder, do you think that was not, I don't think that's not Bryce's request. That was Jessica's move. It was a bold move. Like, I don't think Bryce sent her a text saying, hey, put me on the screen to everyone. She probably sent Jessica a text saying, Micah's here.
No, I thought she said, is it on the screen?
Is it recording? See, this is where.
Yeah, she, well, I don't know. It's hard to interpret. The text from Bryce to Jessica says, are the feeds on yet?
Yep.
So does that mean, are you watching the feeds on your phone? Or does that mean, are you displaying the feeds in the summit?
And this is, like, I think it is a matter of interpretation, because my interpretation is Bryce telling Jessica, like, are the feeds on? Like, are you watching?
Mm-hmm.
And Jessica choosing to have everyone see this play out.
Interesting.
Because if you choose to believe that, then you're choosing to believe that Jespa has some faith in Bryce.
Yeah.
It just, each one will have a different meaning. Now, if you choose to believe that Bryce asked Jespa to do that, then you have an idea that Bryce knows what's about to go down and she's orchestrated the whole thing in a way. In a very light way. But just each of them has, like, different meanings.
Yeah. Do you mind if I look one more thing up?
Yep.
So the thing I wanted to look up is at the start of chapter 77, and it says, but if Jessica had seen her messages, maybe it wouldn't be in vain. Maybe everyone would know what had happened to her. So it's still ambiguous to me.
It's still ambiguous, yeah, like, because, you know, Jessica could be recording it. I mean, and it's also a hell of a thing, a hell of an idea to be like, maybe if I send this, Jessica will put this up on the screen. Like, how does she know people right. aren't at lunch?
Right.
You know, like, so it just, you know, I think that if you go in the way that I like to go, which is Bryce doesn't know that Jessica's projecting it,
mm-hmm.
then that shows Jessica having a certain amount of faith in Bryce.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I choose to live in that reality of cuteness and joy. Bryce also, like, just food is power, coming back to this, right? Like, we haven't seen this in so long, but just, like, Bryce preparing the cheese and wine for Micah, but it's all so performative. Mm-hmm. So it's not even Bryce handing over her power. That's the reason why we haven't seen food as power, is because food isn't power here. She isn't, it's all an act.
It's a distraction. Bryce is holding the power unbeknownst to Micah, because she's using the food as a way to draw the truth out of him.
And to send text messages.
And to buy herself time, yeah, and to set him up.
Yep. Yep. And when the cameras show Bryce clearly afraid, the Autumn King speaks up and says, "Governor, I would like an explanation." Because he cares.
Yeah. And this is not the only time he demonstrates that he cares.
Yeah.
It's frustrating.
It is so frustrating.
But again, I think it can, and we've discussed this in our Flame and Shadow discussion, I think. And this is not a spoiler, I don't think. It's, you can be capable of loving someone in your own way and still be a bad person.
Yes.
And still deserve death.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's what we see with the Autumn King.
No.
Okay.
No. What we see, spoiler for book three, is an absolute lack of follow through.
What I'm seeing, and this is a blooper, what I'm seeing is someone who has a great relationship with their father and someone who doesn't give a shit about their father.
Oh. I was like, who's that? My daddy's dead.
Yeah, but you loved your father.
Yeah, I did. But I see what we're saying here, guys.
I do love my father. But
no, I know, but there is a difference.
There is a difference.
I recognize it.
And it's at this point at the end of the chapter that Micah demands Bryce hand over Luna's horn. And we're all like, what? Bryce has Luna's horn? So we move into chapter 77. And before Micah reveals where Luna's horn is, SJM gives us one last sprinkling of breadcrumbs, which I really, really enjoy, so I have to read them. And these are seen from Hunt's point of view. Quote, "Bryce trembled as the governor ran a possessive hand down the curve of her spine. Hunt saw red at that touch, the entitlement in it, the sheer dread that widened her eyes. Bryce wasn't stupid enough to try to run as Micah ran his fingers down her spine, intent in every stroke." What I really like about this moment is at first it seems hypersexual, and the entitlement to Bryce's body from Micah feels sexual. However, I feel like it disguises a different sort of entitlement and ownership that Micah feels related to Bryce's body, because we don't know yet,
mm-hmm,
that actually what he's touching is the horn in her back.
Yes.
And that's what he feels entitled to.
Yes. I will get into the sexual undertones of it. This is the one part, everything that in this whole scene and how it all plays out, I think it's very well written, expertly written. I know what people are doing at every given point. I don't think she described it well enough that Micah's on her back, not at her front.
Good point. Because I definitely imagined him better at her front, reaching behind
until
her.
Until it says Bryce threw her head back into his nose.
I just imagined her hitting, headbutting him forward.
Did he? Like,
no, I mean, we will discover later in this episode how much I don't pay attention during action scenes.
Yeah, and I want to say I did double check that, but like, she definitely, it is like a, she threw her head back before he could.
Okay.
Yeah, and I was like, wait, are you? But I mean, it is sexual. And everything in his attack, a lot of it is sexual. And I'm going to skip a little bit around in this, but just to kind of give an overall summary. When Micah wants to look at Bryce's back, he tears her top and has her laying face down on the ground with her back facing him. His hands are described as possessive. And not that it's implying that he's going to literally assault her. I think it's more of the symbolism and the awareness that women have when they're being overpowered by men, and just how men can exert their power. It's just kind of, but I also don't think that he's not trying to not show that either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like he's going out of his way to be like, no, I'm only one type of predator. You're safe. He's got all the predator there. The descriptions of him doing all of this is also sexual. You have this moment here where, again, I'm skipping a little bit ahead, but in the moment where Micah puts the synth in her, it's described as, quote, "Micah stabbed the needle into her thigh, draining it to the hilt. She screamed, thrashing." And again, like, we're seeing these parallels to sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a little, it's there. You know, we can't not say that it's there. I don't think that it's saying that it's happening, but it's just, you know, we see the parallels. And I think it adds that other level of fear. But what is also interesting at the same time is that Hunt's being forced down too. Mm-hmm. So there's also that parallel there that he can't move and he has hands, well, invisible hands on him.
Yeah. And we have to remember that this entire chapter is from Hunt's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think SJM did something really, really brilliant in this scene because it would have been easy to mess up. She chose something difficult that she executed well that really has a payoff mm-hmm. at the end of this sequence. By the third person point of view, coming from Hunt's perspective, we get to see the going-ons in both locations, right? If we were in Bryce's perspective solely, we would not be able to see what's happening at the summit. Instead, because we're with Hunt, we get to see what he sees through the cameras as well as what he's witnessing within the conference room. For me, that heightens the action and suspense because we don't know what Bryce is thinking.
Yep.
We're seeing this assault through Hunt's eyes and he's interpreting it as assault, which means it's not good.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're getting the reactions from everybody else in the room that just amps up the energy, right?
Yeah.
Bryce is freaking out. Everybody else in the room is freaking out.
Meanwhile,
Hunt is freaking out.
Meanwhile, Sandriel's like, it's fine, guys. Yeah, she just has bad taste. He has bad taste in women.
That's all. Sandriel.
Thank you for listening to part one of this week's episode of Book Talk for Book Talk. We encourage you to rate and subscribe to our show on your preferred podcast listening platform. Tune in Thursday for part two, where we finish covering this week's chapters.
We would love to hear your thoughts based on today's conversation. You can submit your comments to our form at booktalkforbooktalk.com for a chance to have your feedback discussed during a future mini episode.
If you're enjoying the podcast, please visit our website, booktalkforbooktalk.com, to view our latest merch and learn about supporting the show through Patreon, Ko-Fi, or Venmo.
Bye! Bye.
Hello.
What?
Just preparing emotionally for this. I'm ready.
You ready?
Yeah. I do want to, hold on. It's 680. I just want to confirm. I don't want anyone coming after me saying that she didn't nosebud him.
No, she does nosebutt him.
But I want to make sure that it's front, not that it's back, not front. She says to him, like, then suck these balls or something, right?
Blow me. Yeah, she says blow me.
Blow me. How long does he have her there? Do not lie. Governor ran a possessive hand. You're insane. Cool, that sounds good. Hand didn't let go. So how long is he holding her for?
Oh, you're right. She snapped her head back fast enough that even Micah couldn't stop the collision of her skull with his nose.
I just needed to triple check in case someone was like,
no, totally fine.
You're wrong. Okay, now I'll go into mine. Thank you.
You're welcome.